Hi, podcast listeners. It's Chris Boyd. On KERA Radio, we're busy hosting our winter membership campaign. It's one of the few times each year when we ask listeners to support the programming that KERA provides by making financial contributions to the station. Well, we've decided to experiment with cutting those pitch breaks from the podcast. You won't hear the phone number and wonder if anyone is actually standing by at that very moment to take your call. But we would still really appreciate it if you are able to contribute. Your donation goes to support all the programming you hear on KERA, including our streaming service. And most importantly, it pays for this podcast so that you can listen to Think wherever you are in the world, whenever you are in time. You can make your contribution online at kera.org. It only takes a minute. In fact, you could do it while listening to this podcast. Thanks for listening to Think. Here's today's show.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it take for two combat veterans to recover from physical and psychological wounds and create a life together? Kayla Williams was serving as an Arabic linguist for the U.S. Army when she met the man who would later become her husband, Sergeant Brian McGough. They quickly bonded but had never shared so much as a kiss before McGough was critically wounded by a roadside bomb and sent home. They reconnected months later when Williams' tour ended and she returned from Iraq to Fort Campbell to find McGough coping with the effects of traumatic brain injury. The story of the early years of their relationship is remarkable in part because they kept at it when it was so incredibly hard. While civilian couples might be in a honeymoon phase, Williams was coping with McGough's violent mood swings, mental lapses, and alcohol abuse in the belief that she could help him return to the charismatic and capable self she had fallen for. The new memoir by Kayla Williams is called Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. She is in town for an appearance with the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Kayla, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about the work you were doing with the Army in the Iraq War.
So I enlisted in 2000, and though I had read the fine print and knew that armies went to war, it didn't seem terribly likely.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton was still in office. I chose to be a linguist. They were willing to pay me to learn a foreign language instead of me having to pay somebody else to teach me one. And I was randomly computer-generated number assigned Arabic instead of Korean or Chinese. And I was learning Arabic at the Defense Language Institute on 9/11. So at that moment, I knew my career was going to be very different than I might otherwise have imagined. I was assigned to the 101st Airborne Division, Air Assault, and took part of the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003 as part of the You Go to War with the Army You Have era. So as a woman who was barred by policy from direct ground combat, I was not issued flak vests because there weren't enough. Hmm. I'm sorry, plates for my flak vests.
Yeah. So you had one, it just didn't have any Kevlar inside.
Right, no, yeah. Right, no, no, nothing to stop a fast or a big bullet. And yet there also weren't enough Arabic linguists to go around, so I ended up going on combat foot patrols with the infantry in Baghdad to translate between those troops and the Iraqi civilians that they encountered. And that was far outside of what I had been trained to do, which was signals intelligence, intercept and direction finding on enemy communications. Hmm. And then the division pushed farther north out to Mosul and beyond to Tal Afar and to Sinjar Mountain, where I spent several months.
The translation must be fascinating because it's not simply a matter of taking one word and finding the other word in a language. You're also sort of reading facial expressions and trying to understand nuance. Talk a little bit about how you found your way to doing that, and is there an advantage to being a woman in those situations?
The biggest challenge at the beginning was that the Army taught us modern standard Arabic, kind of like the Queen's English.
Uh-huh.
And then we were dropped somewhere that they spoke the Iraqi dialect, which is very far removed from modern standard. So I had to very quickly try to dredge up any memories of the brief exposure I'd gotten to Iraqi dialect and try to remember that and get used to speaking the way that people could understand. More importantly, understanding them. They generally could understand me, but I did not understand them. So that was a quick adjustment that I had to make. Being a woman, I think, was very helpful. I am less physically imposing than, say, my husband. He's a full foot taller than I am. So in all of our gear and equipment, he just looks much more intimidating. And also, so in a Muslim country, predominantly Muslim country, for local women, the fact that I was a woman made it much easier for them to approach me, mm-hmm. especially in more traditional communities. There are restrictions on women talking to strange men. So they were able to come up to me and talk to me about their issues and concerns, which was fantastic.
So how did you and Brian, the man who would become your mm-hmm. husband, meet, and what drew you to him initially?
So when we were on the side of Sinjar Mountain, first, I was the only woman with maybe 7 or 8 troops, part of a LPOP, a listening post observation post. My team did the listening. A team of artillery troops did the observing. And then they later moved us to the other side of the mountain. I was the only woman with maybe 20 or 30 men. And Brian was in charge of the fire support team, the artillery guys who were up there doing the observing. He would bring them resupply. He would spell them if one of them had to go down for a break or go out on mid-tour leave, something like that. And that's where I met him. Now, this was very early in the war, the summer of 2003. We didn't have port-a-johns, didn't have electricity, not even generators. So no chance to watch TV or DVDs, play video games, do anything but talk. Mm-hmm. So we all spent a lot of time talking and getting to know one another. And Brian was tall, handsome, funny, sarcastic, witty, clearly very smart, self-confident, charismatic. I felt an immediate attraction towards him, but it's not a romantic place. It's not like, you know, we could go clubbing or go for a lovely dinner. So we would tease one another and kind of make fun of one another. And then one night I confessed to him that I really wanted to get to know him better. And he said, "Don't worry, there's plenty of time for that when we get home." Mm. And just a few months later, he was injured.
How did you find out about his injury? And mm-hmm. because initially it looked like maybe he wasn't so badly hurt, and then things went south very quickly.
So I was not on the convoy when it got hit. He was coming back from mid-tour leave and was actually on a bus, which they never used again. But the convoy was hit in one of the first coordinated attacks that our unit took in what later came to be known as the insurgency. The convoy took small arms fire, RPG fire, and was hit by a roadside bomb. And shrapnel penetrated the back of Brian's skull underneath his Kevlar, traveled forward, and exited near his right eye. I was, by chance, down at our forward operating base instead of up on the mountain where I usually was. And we heard that the convoy had been hit. A staff sergeant from my unit was also injured, but not severely wounded. He was returned to duty, back to work in a couple of days. And so I was helping to wash some blood out of his gear so we could give it back to him in clean condition. And I bumped into Brian's platoon sergeant, and he said, "Oh, yeah, Williams, I know you really liked McGuff, and sorry to tell you, it looks like he's not going to make it." And for several days, they said, "Don't expect him to live. And if he does live, don't expect him to be able to communicate," anything like that. So it was tough to know. At the very beginning, when he sustained the injury, as you mentioned, he was doing surprisingly well. He had a piece of the shrapnel was still lodged in his skull, but he was at that point walking and talking. And that he surprised a lot of people by how badly he ended up being wounded, but then surprised the neurosurgeon by how well he recovered. He had suffered, among other injuries, an artery inside his skull had been severed. So he was bleeding out inside his skull, mm-hmm. which is what killed the actress Natasha Richardson. Puts pressure on the brain. She had a closed skull injury, had an open skull injury, but that is the most life-threatening part of his injury. So by the time he got to Baghdad, he started to crash and would have died if he hadn't gotten surgery right away.
He was supposed to later have surgery to repair the hole in his skull. Why didn't he get that?
They said that the muscle had regrown over that area well enough that they didn't want to muck around any further. They mm-hmm. just didn't. They decided they would just leave well enough alone since he seemed to be doing okay.
So when you finally got back stateside and he was already there, you decided to reconnect. And it's so interesting the way you write about this, because you have this connection with him. But I mean, it's almost like you had no right to. You were close friends, but you hadn't even been dating.
Right.
Talk about what you expected that reunion to feel like and how it played out.
So I didn't know anything about brain injuries. And when he had emailed me from the hospital, had moved to somewhere that I actually had access to email. And he said, "Oh, they said I'm going to be fine." And I just took him at his word. There were a lot of typos and misspellings in the email, yeah. but I thought that was just like people get lazy in email. So I maybe was willfully ignoring it. But
like that it was a sign of cognitive
right,
damage.
It did not occur to me that it could be a sign of cognitive damage. I thought, oh, he's just being being lazy. And I had, I mean, I was in my late 20s by then already, but I kind of felt like a teenager. I had like a crush on him. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to get home. And I didn't know what would happen. I like wanted him to like me and wanted us to hang out, but I didn't have any strong expectations. But I went and picked him up the day that we got home, February 8th, 2004. And there was an immediate spark. And we spent the next month together. I had block leave, so a month of vacation. And he was not. I assumed he was also on block leave. And we just spent all of our time together doing whatever we wanted, going for hikes, going to art museums, going out to eat, drinking probably way too much beer and going out to bars. So it was that first month really was like a homecoming. We were just so happy to be alive. And I either out of ignorance or denial didn't notice or acknowledge the hints that I later saw more clearly of the cognitive deficits and psychological injuries that he had suffered.
Well, and I guess everybody in that early phase is kind of on their best behavior, right? I mean, not that some of the things that he later struggled with were within his control, but it makes sense that you're going to not focus on things that are a sign of trouble.
Yeah, I think for me, that's true. I just wasn't focusing on things that were a sign of trouble. And for him, I came to find later, people with brain injuries often do better in a structured environment. Mm-hmm. So in the hospital, as an inpatient, in a structured environment, he had done really well enough that they were ready to release him, though part of that was ignorance on their part. The doctor literally said to him, well, you're doing well enough to walk and talk and wipe your own butt, so we're sending you home. They didn't have room for him to stay an inpatient at that point. And when he got home and was in a completely unstructured environment and had a lot more responsibilities, like the need to pay his bills and manage his household, he was not prepared for that. But nobody had assessed his abilities or readiness to do that. And nobody came to follow up and check on him and see whether or not he was able to handle that. And that was a big gap in what the Army was able to do in those early days of the war.
Kayla Williams is my guest. She's a former Arabic linguist for the U.S. Army and author of the new memoir, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Kayla Williams, a former Arabic linguist for the U.S. Army and author of the new book, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. She's in town for an address this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Kayla, you said that not long after you got back, you realized that Brian was struggling to do things as simple as, like, keep up with the electric bill or the water bill. At what point did you realize that this was more than somebody who'd been partying too hard and just had forgotten?
When I went back to work. When my block leave was over, I had to go and do my day job, which is when the Army isn't at war, it's preparing to go to war. So we started training and refitting our equipment and getting everybody ready to redeploy. Mm-hmm. And Brian did not go back to work. I learned that his unit had said, just stay home. He had a fresh enough injury that he couldn't wear his headgear, which the Army's really big on people wearing their hats. And he couldn't carry a weapon because of the post-traumatic stress disorder that he was developing. And they said, you're scaring the new guys when they show up because, you know, fresh out of basic training. Yeah, and he looks messed up. And so just stay home. Don't come in. And when I was, you know, popping up at 5:30 in the morning to go in and work out and then working all day and then I had to go to sleep early at night, I started to realize, oh, he's not staying up to party. He's staying up because he has horrible nightmares mm-hmm. that prevent him from sleeping. Oh, he's drinking lots of whiskey to try to prevent those from happening. it's not just for fun. And then I started to notice that the bills weren't getting paid. He was getting those, you know, notices with the red stamps on them from the electric company, the water company. That's when I started to really become aware that there were some serious problems and that the Army was not helping him manage those problems.
Yeah, this was early, relatively early in
the war,
and the services that now have been sort of built,
institutionalized.
Yeah, just didn't exist. And at times he was treated like a malingerer.
Yeah, his physician's assistant, I look back, I just can't believe it. At the time, I couldn't believe it. And now I'm even more astonished. When Brian would go to seek medical assistance, the physician's assistant assigned to his artillery battery at one point said, like, this is all in your head. Brian's like, yes, there is literally shrapnel in my brain. Mm-hmm. It is in my head, but not the way that you mean it. So he would miss appointments because with the brain injury, he would mix up 10 a.m., 11 a.m., 1 p.m. Mm-hmm. It just, he couldn't track that. But the PA was just very ignorant about traumatic brain injuries and said that Brian was refusing to go to appointments. You know, if you have a patient with a brain injury, you should probably call them the day before in the morning of to remind them of their appointment. Now I get, I mean, things have changed, but I get text message reminders for my kids' dental appointments. Like, mm-hmm. why can't they get that in place for adults, you know, especially with special problems?
Well, he also had these flashes of real rage, so many of which were directed at you. And you had friends saying, listen, this is not going to work out. What caused you to think, to recognize where this was coming from and believe that you could work through it?
Part of it was the military ethos of leave no fallen comrade behind. Hmm. You know, I just, if we were still in Iraq on the battlefield and I saw him lying there wounded, I wouldn't just wander off and leave him there. I couldn't do the same now that we were home. And I knew that the problems he was having were caused by enemy action. They weren't just that he was lazy or a jerk. He had a very serious physiological injury that was leading to cognitive and psychological deficits as well. So I couldn't bring myself to leave him behind. And part of it's also ethical. I mean, if I had gotten breast cancer and he'd been like, oh, it's really annoying to deal with your illness, I'm going to leave you. Like that's not what you do mm-hmm. when you care about somebody. So I stuck with it. I also believed, I held onto this faith that he would get better, which wasn't necessarily grounded in any research or, you know, I didn't have any factual basis for believing that, but mm-hmm. I clung to that conviction and luckily ended up being right.
Well, you know, what's so interesting about this story is that you were also dealing with, if it was not severe PTSD, you know, a sort of jumpiness when, you know, doors would slam and things would happen. I wonder if focusing on Brian's injury caused you to neglect your own healing.
Neglect it or think it was less important, definitely. My symptoms were actually very normal. I came to understand that much later. A lot of what we think of as symptoms of post-traumatic stress, when you're in a combat zone, are very adaptive. Mm-hmm. They're survival mechanisms. If you are extremely alert to any possible danger, any potential threat lurking in your environment, and ready to respond with immediate violence if you sense that threat, this keeps you alive in a war zone. It's a good way to be. Mm-hmm. And it's fairly normal that sticks with you when you come home for a few months. It takes time to dial your responses back to normal so that if a car cuts you off in traffic, you don't have that same reaction that you're ready to kill them because you think they're threatening you.
Right.
So for me, the vast majority of my symptoms faded within 3 to 6 months, which is the very normal timeline. And it was very helpful when I spent time around other combat vets who admitted that they were feeling the same way. Mm-hmm. They would lose their tempers, feel really angry, had trouble sleeping, had bad dreams. And that made me realize, okay, I'm not crazy. Like, this is normal. And as I started to feel better, that was really reassuring for me. But I do also think that my own early symptoms of post-traumatic stress made Brian's seem somewhat more normal to me. Mm-hmm. It was a more extreme version of what I was feeling, but it wasn't something completely kooky. It was like, oh yeah,
you could relate to how he was feeling.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You want to walk out of the restaurant because it's loud and crowded? I totally understand that. Sure, mm-hmm. No problem. Let's go.
Yeah. You write that you also had trouble relating to civilian women, even when they meant well. Like, their problems just didn't mesh with yours.
Yes. And that lingers to an extent today. If I hear somebody, women or men, complaining that, like, oh, my latte took 5 minutes. It's like the worst day ever. I'm like, really? The worst day ever? Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah.
Are we being a wee bit melodramatic? And not that I don't have my moments of melodrama, but I try to at least make fun of myself. But being in a war zone and being in Iraq, you know, at the time that we were there, a third world country, people wanted our empty cardboard boxes to use for flooring. So to come back and realize that there really are women who complain if their boyfriends leave the toilet seat up, it seemed baffling. I'm like, but we have a toilet. Like, I love the toilet.
After living for months without one.
Without one, right. Mm-hmm. So I'm perfectly capable of lowering the lid. Like, let's have some perspective. Is it going to kill you? No? Okay, it's probably not that important.
Hmm. We have an email here from Steve who asks if you can talk about any change of heart about the U.S. invasion of Iraq and your thoughts on the Iraqi people.
I didn't so much have a change of heart because I didn't support it when we went in. Mm-hmm. I thought that the reasons we were given for invading Iraq were disingenuous at their best, and went because I swore an oath to protect and defend the Constitution and to obey the lawful orders of those above me. And the invasion of Iraq was authorized by duly elected members of U.S. Congress. So off we went. When we first got there, and the Iraqi people would come up to me and tell me how they had personally suffered under the Hussein regime, I started to think, well, maybe even if we went in for the wrong reasons, we did the right thing. And then, as we were unable to provide basic security, help them restore essential services, and their resentment and anger at their negative situation started to rise, I once again was back to questioning, like, what have we done? We mm-hmm. didn't have an adequate plan for securing the peace, although we really did a fantastic job at winning the war. The Iraqi people that I personally met who were willing to come up to me as a U.S. soldier and as a woman in their country, they were unfailingly generous. Many of the people I met were very poor, and yet they would still share what little they had. They would bring us tea. They bring me eggs. I got to try turkey eggs, really cool, vegetables. They were generally very kind. I did meet people who had some anger and resentment, which I get. I mean, it's if you've seen Red Dawn, like Wolverines, you don't really want foreigners invading your country.
Right.
But I never stopped seeing the Iraqis as people. And I think speaking the language helped with that. Though towards the end of the deployment, and especially after Brian was injured, it was really hard to hold on to that and not get angry. When you go somewhere because you're told you're going to bring freedom and democracy and you're helping people and they start trying to kill you, it's really hard to not get angry that mm-hmm. people are shooting at you.
And when you have to potentially be ready to shoot back, I would imagine that a little bit of dehumanizing of the people who shoot at you is necessary.
It's what's supposed to happen. And I think that as an Arabic linguist, that was complicated for me. It was difficult. I read a book by a journalist named Aidan Hartley that I really liked, called The Zanzibar Chest. And he quoted a UN official who was involved in an operation in Africa saying that the UN soldiers there were expected to have a gun in one hand and a spoon in the other. Hmm. And that really resonated with me, that sense of like the cognitive dissonance of trying to hold those two contradictory and like in some ways mutually exclusive tasks in your mind at the same time. You know, oh, we're here to help you, but I will kill you if you threaten me. It's very, I think it's really tough on troops.
And it's kind of unprecedented, right? In U.S. history, we haven't been in this kind of conflict before.
Certainly not for as long as we were.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking this hour with author Kayla Williams. She's a former Arabic linguist for the U.S. Army and author of the new memoir, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. She's in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find information about that at dfwworld.org. Right now, if you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Kayla Williams, a former Arabic linguist for the U.S. Army. Her new memoir is called Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Kayla, how did you and Brian decide to get married when you were in love, but things were far from perfect?
So Brian had been sent back to Walter Reed when I saw how much he was stagnating and kind of getting worse at Fort Campbell. I started harassing people and his mother started harassing people, and we got him transferred back to Walter Reed to be an outpatient but have more regular care. And being away from one another helped us both realize that we did want to be with one another. Mm-hmm. And we actually got married on February 18th, 2004.
So, happy 10th anniversary, yes, plus 2 days.
Ninth anniversary. I just missed it. I'm sorry, 2005.
Okay.
We started dating 2004, got married 2005. Mm-hmm. I apologize. So I went up for, you know, a short trip. We got married because he was living in this awful little apartment and I was worried about losing my health insurance when I got out of the Army. So we did the deed, but just told everyone we were engaged and still had a big public wedding later that year. But yeah, it was a complicated set of reasons. There were immediate benefits to us getting married with the military system. And I knew that I wanted to be with him and thought this gave us the best chance for me to be able to support him in his recovery. I would get to go to appointments with him. Doctors would give me information. So that was how I knew that I could help him best. But yeah, I'm not sure that it was a completely rational decision to marry somebody who was definitely still struggling and had a long way to go in his recovery.
Well, sometimes in these stories, the marriage is sort of the happily ever after. And for you, we are still mid-story.
Yeah, Disney lies.
Yeah.
So all of these, and not just cartoons, but all these romantic comedies, you know, the chase, the romance is the key thing. And then after the wedding, and then they lived happily ever after. No, that's a myth. Marriage is hard work. It's worth it. I'm happy to be married. I love my husband, but it takes a lot of hard work and commitment. It isn't getting the wedding isn't the end. It's the beginning.
You describe in the book a really harrowing account of a terrible night that you had together that could have, I mean, it's almost like miraculous that it didn't end in utter tragedy.
Yes. We eventually hit rock bottom, and I was so afraid that things would never get better. And when he was medically retired, one of his case managers said, "Why didn't you go for rehab, inpatient cognitive rehab?" And he couldn't have just sent himself as a soldier. That's not how things work. And then she very flippantly said, "Oh, well, it's too late now. Any improvements you were going to see would have been in the first 18 months." Huh. And this was devastating for me because I had been banking on him getting better.
Yeah.
And then he was medically retired with no notice. We didn't see it coming as suddenly as it did, though we'd been looking towards it for a couple of years. And then without his income, and I was waiting for my job to start, we both ended up on unemployment. And so we're there. Just it felt like we had no future. And I reached a point where I thought, I can't do this. I can't live like this for the rest of my life. And I decided that if he had these horrible rages where the PTSD would just take over, I said, "All right, just let the rage take you. We have a gun. Just kill me. End it. I can't do this anymore." And he put the gun to my head and pulled the trigger. It was empty. And I left. I went and stayed in a hotel and didn't know if I would ever go back. But the next day, I fell and broke my ankle. And he had to come and meet me at the emergency room so that I could get health care. And he didn't even remember the night before. He'd been very drunk when it happened. Mm-hmm. And weirdly enough, that was the turning point that changed everything. I was helpless. I was laid up on the couch, had to have my foot elevated above my heart. And Brian was forced to take care of me, get me coffee, fix me food, run all of our errands. He was put back in a position that he had been in when he was in the military, as a leader, as somebody who took care of others. And I was forced to empathize with what it is like to be cared for.
And to need help.
That what it's like to need help. I had just been in total like fix it mode. Mm-hmm. You know, I will solve all the problems. I will do all of the things. And being unable to do that anymore made me empathize with him instead of just trying to fix him. And that helped set us on the road to recovery. Brian ended up getting a part-time job, first just stocking shelves at a sporting goods store. And then he realized that he could do something. Then he got a promotion. He realized he could do something well. And then we started volunteering with veterans organizations, one called VoteVets.org that helps get veterans elected to public office. He ended up getting hired by them to make serving other veterans his career. We both found that being open and honest about the barriers that we had faced and the gaps in services that we had experienced could be a way to improve things for those veterans still coming home after us. And as we gradually formed a community of our peers and took on new challenges, he exhibited tremendous cognitive growth and psychological growth as well. He stopped drinking too much, and this negative downward spiral he had been on before went in reverse as an upward spiral where every good thing built on every other good thing. And slowly we were able to come to a new normal where we live fulfilling lives and are contributing members of our community and serve society in new ways.
We have an email here from Kay who says, the Veterans Recovery Center, where I volunteer teaching creative writing and computers at the VA hospital in Dallas, has a successful outpatient program for veterans living with PTSD, addiction, and brain trauma. I returned to Dallas a widow with PTSD after living in Vietnam in 1968 to 1970, married to an Air America pilot killed flying in Laos. She says, biofeedback and writing and teaching helped me cope. I'm eager to read Kayla's book and appreciate her speaking out for veterans.
Well, thank you so much for that very kind email, Kay, and I'm deeply sorry for your loss. And yes, all of the things that she mentions are why I wrote this book, to let people know that there is a road to recovery, that there are effective evidence-based treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder, and people should seek help if they need it. It's hard when you come out of the military to admit that you can't do everything by yourself, that you may need some professional help, but help can make a difference. And there are nonprofits out there to help for military families. Blue Star Families is a great one to find a connection, a community of your peers. For veterans, going to VA is a great place to start. But if vets are uncomfortable with that, there are community resources that they can turn to. Veterans in crisis can call 1-800-273-TALK and press 1 for 24-hour assistance if they are reaching a crisis point. There are a lot of great organizations out there trying to make a difference, and a lot of ways that veterans can recover. It may be different. You know, for me, writing has been a great part of my own healing process. For others, adaptive sports, if they've sustained a severe injury, or just sports in general, can be a great thing to do. Running, getting your brain to kick out those endorphins and help stabilize your moods. There are many different roads to recovery, but there are so many ways that people can come back from very severe trauma.
What would you say to members of the civilian population who struggle sometimes? It seems like there are two extremes, either assuming that every returning vet is permanently damaged in some way
broken.
And unable to broken, right? As opposed to those who think, well, you look fine, you must be fine. How can we be empathetic and helpful, but not sort of make any assumptions that may or may not be true?
Yeah, I think it's tough. And it's tough for me as an advocate to balance calling attention to the gaps in services that exist and say we need to help those veterans who are struggling, while at the same time not adding to this narrative that vets are broken, unemployed, yeah, homeless, suicidal. And it's really, I think, difficult to communicate this nuance that over a lifetime, veterans are, by and large, more highly educated, more highly employed, and more highly paid than their civilian peers who have never served. But for a minority of veterans, that homecoming, that reintegration, proves to be an incredibly difficult one. So we do see high rates of homelessness in the veteran population and high rates of suicide. And that is, I think, a tough thing to say. Like, if you look at us as a group, we do very well. But there are pockets within the veterans community where people have significant needs for additional assistance, a hand up, not a hand out, as they're coming home from war, and assistance reintegrating into the communities that they came from and getting some treatment for mental health or other needs. And I think the biggest thing is to not make assumptions. My husband does not have a visible injury unless he cuts his hair very short, but he was very grievously wounded. Others may have similar invisible wounds. And you also have troops who have sustained amputations who have been able to continue on active duty. Mm-hmm. And over 50 have now redeployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. So they have a much more visible injury than my husband, but have been able to continue their military careers. So the range of experience is really very, very wide, very diverse. And the best thing to do is to ask questions, to listen to great programs like this one, to read books like mine, of course, or blogs. There are lots of great ways that you can learn about the experiences of veterans, and try to open your mind to hearing and truly listening to the experiences of our returning troops and military family members. There was a great piece written recently by, I want to say, Phil Clay, where he said, "Stop saying I can't imagine how awful it was to go to war. Try to imagine." Hmm. You know, we watch 12 Years a Slave to try to imagine what it was like to be a slave. We're willing to watch movies about fighting space aliens. We try to imagine what it's like to be on a spaceship fighting space aliens. Try to imagine what it's like for our service members to go to war and then come home.
The new memoir by Kayla Williams is called Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. She's in town for an appearance tonight for the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Kayla, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.